Well, I've really been enjoying these books. Your heroes are so unlikely. I mean, I never even knew that there was such a thing as the Navajo tribal police.
Oh, yeah, 108, or last I counted, 108 sworn officers and a bureaucracy and the whole package, just like a city, except, of course, they cover a territory that's big as New England, approximately, 25 million square miles.
With 108 people? Well, they get some help, though, don't they?
Well, not much. Well, they hit the Arizona State Highway Patrol goes through there, and maybe the Utah Highway Patrol might dip down into the Utah end. And some help on what they call a checkerboard from the New Mexico State Police, and a few county sheriffs. Yeah, they get some help, but not a lot.
But I noticed in A Thief of Time, helicopters are used. That probably helps.
It was a rental helicopter.
Yeah, the rental
helicopter. The police don't own one. There's a medical service helicopter, two of them, I think, that operate on the reservation to bring in the dog bite and bubonic plague victims and, you know.
Of course, we know there is crime out there in the West, as you have well established in some, I guess, 9 novels. But with 108 police officers in this vast tract, it must be relatively peaceful.
The Navajos are a peaceful people, and of course it's a very empty country. You can go out there and spend a day and not see anybody. You know, it's empty, empty, empty. It's dry country, a lot of it, and where there's not water, there's no people. And, you know, most of the Navajos, a lot of them haul water, some for miles, in barrels in the back of their pickup trucks to live off of. So, no, it's thinly populated and clustered. You know, you have people cluster where there's a source of water, as much as they can.
Well, tell me about the evolution of your characters. Now, Jim Chee, he is a medicine man as well as a police officer.
Jim Chee is trying to be a medicine man. It's a tough road to hoe. You have to find somebody who's willing to teach you, and then you pay him a fee, and you intern with him, usually for years, maybe 8 or 9 years, to learn a big chant, like a night way chant or a blessing way. And then you have to have customers. You know, the word gets around, here's a shaman, a hatali, and Chi hadn't found any customers yet, except one, his own family a little.
Now, is this belief in Indian medicine men, is this more of a tradition, a custom, or do people actually believe in
it? Oh, yeah, the curing ceremonials are still held. They're expensive. The full-scale one, the thing that Chi does, he's going to be a blessing way singer, and that takes 8 days, and it's expensive because your family comes in, your clan comes in to help, you know, to lend moral support. They're very psychological, very Freudian operations in curing. And the host family is supposed to feed them, and then they pay the medicine people. And some ceremonials take more than one medicine person. The enemy way takes two, for example. And the ceremony like the night way chant, you need to hire a team of Yebiche. These are professionals who represent the holy people, the gods. They come masked and costumed and dance the traditional origin story dances. And young people, young men who want to be initiated then, I think it's the fourth night, a special ceremony for them, sort of a confirmation, if they were Catholics.
Mm. Now, Leaphorn, he's a little different. Seems to be a little more of a practical man, mourning the death of his wife, about to retire. Tell me how he evolved.
Well, I was a reporter. I covered a case involving an Apache tribal policeman who had shot to death by some people he caught stealing gasoline. And before he died, he'd shot one of them. And the circumstances stuck in my mind, and I thought, when the time comes that I'm going to write a novel, you know, this kind of stuff, I'm going to use an Apache tribal policeman, this guy with a jicarilla. But when the time came to do it, the Navajos they're such a big tribe and such an important tribe, and their religion and their metaphysics are so attractive to me, complicated, rich, that I decided to make it a Navajo.
So you get more to work with.
Yeah, more to work with. I started out with in the first story, oddly enough, with an older man, and it just seemed to me this is I don't know exactly why he became the way he did become. But in my mind, that's the way the fella is. He's cynical. He's pragmatic. He's skeptical. He respects his own way, but he respects it as an abstraction. You know, he sees the beauty in the abstract notions of the Navajo way, but he doesn't respect the taboos specifically as taboos.
Now, Leaphorn and Chi have worked together, I believe, in the last three books. Last two books.
Yeah.
Now,
mm-hmm.
But before, the books dealt with each man individually.
That's true. I started with Leaphorn. Mm-hmm. I wrote three books in which Leaphorn was used. I got the fourth one. I wanted to set it in the so-called checkerboard reservation, that part of the reservation that slops over into New Mexico and is a Duke's mixture of Navajos, Zunis, Apaches, white people, you know, all mixed together. I wanted a younger man, a less sophisticated, still fascinated by the peculiarities of the white culture, see. And I was going to revert Leaphorn back, make him young, but it didn't work. He'd already taken on a personality of my mind, and I couldn't make it go. And so I started me a young fellow, romantic, traditional. I had a second complication. I lost the television rights to Leaphorn. So I was motivated by greed as well as art. I thought, I don't want to, you know, continue working on a character when I've lost, you know, his right arm from the elbow down. Don't own all of him, see. I got him back. I have him back now. I bought, ransomed him.
You bought him back?
Bought him back. $22,000.
How does this work? You have to buy your own character?
No, I'd signed a foolish contract, and the guy that owned it kept paying the options, renewing the options, and the option price applied against the television rights, see. Television rights, not the, he didn't, and then when he paid enough to buy that, he stopped, and he owned the continuing character rights to Leaphorn, see,
for television. Literary or television?
Just television.
Just television.
Not movie, not literary.
But you bought the television rights
back. I bought the television rights back.
But you never lost the literary rights?
No, just the television rights, but still, you know, matter of principle.
One thing about fiction is that not only does it tell us about the way we think and how we live and gets us within our emotions in a way that nonfiction can't do, but it also tells us facts the way nonfiction does. And in A Thief of Time, I found out something. I had no idea about a lot of different things, but I had no idea the archaeological nature of this area and the quest to find these artifacts and the pots. Tell me about, I had no idea that this was something important and of value, that these things would be auctioned and all of that. Tell me about
that. The first place, that area, that Four Corners area, was a great, strange civilization, rose and fell over a period of about almost 1,000 years, the Anasazi, and built those cliff dwellings and those great kivas and a ceremonial system and roads and all sorts of things we don't really understand. And then all of a sudden, really, literally all of a sudden, they went away. And they never came back. In some cases, they left valuable things sitting around. Just didn't even bother to take them with them. We thought 10 or 15 years ago we knew a lot about them, and the more they dig, the instead of finding answers, they find more questions. But the collectors of such things have created a substantial market for ancient pre-Columbian pottery. In the Sotheby's catalog, the last one I looked at had Anasazi pots for maybe, I think the most expensive one was $7,000. But sometimes they're as high as $30,000. And since they buried pots with their inner burials, and if you have a front-end loader or a bulldozer, you know, you can see how looters would be attracted to this when there are literally tens of thousands of sites that have never been excavated, scattered all over New Mexico, Utah, Arizona, Colorado, that corner, that Four Corners area.
But In terms of the archaeology, we don't know why these people vanished. Are there any theories?
Plenty of theories. There was a great, two great droughts that would have affected one of them last 20-something years. Would have diminished population, but in many cases they lived on beyond those droughts and then left. There's a some of the questions why you can see why they left Chaco Canyon, which was one of their great ceremonial centers, because there's little water and virtually no firewood. You know, you need wood, obviously, to live with. And yet the same situation existed when they first moved there. Again, no firewood and very little water. What attracted them in the first place? And why did they build these great roads that spiral out from these centers when they had no wheels and no pack animals? You don't need roads for people on foot.
Well, in Thief of Time, you have a woman anthropologist. Anthropologist, is that correct?
Yeah, that's...
And of course, she's searching for pots. But how much more light can be shed on these people by continued excavations? Isn't this just repeating itself?
It is... they're beginning, for example, to learn... they can now tell year by year almost what their protein intake was, how much corn they were eating. As a corn consumption became a major part of their diet, their birth rate fell. They're beginning to learn things like this. And as their birth rate fell, a sudden new emphasis on Coccapelli, the fertility figure, appeared. It's a good question, though. I wonder myself how much more they can learn.
Well, I think you answered it. We are learning more.
They seem to be learning more. They're opening a new ruins in Crow Canyon in southwestern Colorado, Sand Canyon, where they think they're beginning to. It's amazing. I can ramble on about it.
Well, of course, there is this feeling that maybe it's good to let the dead lie.
Yeah, there's that.
Even after all of the centuries.
But the human curiosity about this civilization and what happened to it. I mean, I love mysteries, and here's a real one that I thought was kind of nice to set my own mystery, created my own imagination right in the middle of a enduring Anasazi mystery.
A mystery within a mystery. It's interesting, too. You cannot remove these artifacts from public land, but you can on private land.
Yeah, uh-huh. And there are literally thousands and thousands and thousands of these ruins on private land. If you know what to look for, you look for a certain kind of salt bush, two-winged salt, four-winged salt bush, tends to grow where soil's been disturbed, even hundreds of years ago. So people go around looking for that particular, they even spot it from helicopters, see. And now, of course, the ruins are sunk under the earth, little mounds, but the pot hunters know how to find them.
How did you develop this fascination, almost obsession, I guess, with Indians, Navajos in particular?
Well, I was born in a little community, Sacred Heart, Oklahoma. Our neighbors were Potawatomis and Seminoles, mostly. It was a population 60.
Oklahoma?
Yeah. They were different kind of Indians, of course, but grew up, went to an Indian school, grew up not knowing I was any different from an Indian, see? And really, you're not, which is a hard lesson to learn if you don't learn it till you're mature. When I first saw Navajos, I was back on a convalescent furlough from World War II, and I was driving a truck out there, and I blundered into a what you call an enemy way ceremonial, a curing ceremonial that a family was having for one of its sons that just back from the Marine Corps in the Pacific, and they were restoring him to harmony to live with the people after exposure to alien culture. See. And it's a very colorful and beautiful ceremony. I saw a little of it, and I was intrigued. And that was 1945. Here it is, 1988, and I'm still intrigued. You know, and I've got a lot of Navajo friends, and I've read everything I can find about Navajos, which is a volume. By now they know me on the reservation, and they know I'm a respectful, my interest is respectful, and I even have Navajos come to me to ask questions about their religion. When I taught at the university, it was not uncommon for Navajo students to come and ask me about various things.
Are the Navajos reading your books?
Yeah, they use them in their schools, and I have parents tell me, and I love to hear this, that couldn't get my kids interested in the Navajo culture, and then they made them read your books in school, and they come to me, and they're full of questions. Is this what's behind this, and is this the way it works? And of course, it pleases the parents, pleases me too.
And of course, the information is accurate.
It is. If I can, I go to great effort to make it accurate. The tribe, in fact, gave me a plaque last year, declaring me to be a special friend of the Navajo for my accurate and, how did they put it, my accurate and sensitive depiction of the traditional Navajo culture.
Mm. You live in Albuquerque.
That's right, yeah.
So that's really...
Nearby. The Canyoncito Reservation is only about 30 miles from my house. One of the offshoot reservations.
Well, before you became a novelist, you were in journalism, weren't you?
I spent 17 years as a police reporter and a political writer and an editor, and then I taught journalism for 20 years at the University of New Mexico.
It seems to me it's tough for most people in journalism to go into fiction. I mean, there are exceptions, and you're one of them, and there are several others. I mean, everybody cites Hemingway, for example, but... I don't know. It seems that most journalists are hard-bitten people who don't seem to have this fictional drive.
Well, when you look at look down the tube at American Letters, you see Theodore Dreiser, you see, you mentioned Hemingway, you see Walt Whitman, you see the author of Stephen Crane, you see, in fact, you have to look hard to find exceptions. Henry James is an exception, Faulkner is an exception, and beyond those two, even Willa Cather was a journalist. There's a high percentage of the bellwether people in American Letters who came out of journalism. Well, in the mystery field, for example, Parker's off the Boston Globe.
Mm-hmm. Gregory O'Donnell.
Yeah, about at a Mystery Writers of America session, about half the guys you're drinking beer with are old newspaper people. It's
okay, I'm wrong. but the work is so different.
In a way it is, but look, I need a character, right? I need a kind of guy that you'll believe would casually kill somebody. In my memory, I remember covering an execution in the gas chamber. I remember talking to the guy. I remember what he told me, and there he is. I mean, you understand why. How first a fella can get asocial and kill casually, see? You know, you've covered his trial. Or you need somebody who's recovering from grief, and you remember standing there where the building is burning down, and here's a guy, he's escaped from that building, and he's left his children behind to die. You know, and you've interviewed him. So you accumulate, as a journalist, a whole head full of the raw material of fiction. People under stress.
Mm-hmm.
Responding to crisis.
That's true, but I think even people not in journalism collect these raw feelings as well, because they'll see suicides, they'll see random acts of violence, they'll see all different...
Yeah, but how many? The first day I went to work on a newspaper, I had to go to a chemical plant where four guys had been sandblasting a water tower, and somebody turned on the wrong hose and released natural gas instead of compressed air, and it blew all four of them up.
Oh, boy.
And there they are, you know, and I'm talking to their wives who hurried down to find out what happened to their husband, you know, the first day. You know, and then 3 days later, I'm covering a murder trial. My point is you're immersed in it as a reporter, especially as a police reporter.
Now, what prompted you to go into journalism?
I wasn't good at anything else. When I got out of the Army, I came back to the States with a bad leg and a bad eye, and we'd sold a farm. We'd been about to lose it. You know, we were marginal farmers, and my dad had died, and my brother and I had been running the farm. He'd gone in service. I'd gone in service.
This is still Oklahoma.
Yeah. A feature writer on the Daily Oklahoman had done a feature story about me. She told my mother... She'd gotten letters from my mother, and she told my mother, when he gets back, I'd like to talk to him. So I went down to see her, and her name was Beatrice Stahl, and she said, you should be a writer, see? So I thought, well, why not? I like to read, and, you know, I'd kind of like to write.
Anybody who can read can write.
Right. So I went to journalism school. You know, thank God for the GI Bill, a great friend of mine had gone to the Marine Corps when I was in the Army, and like he came back also as shot up. He was going to always had his dream of being a surgeon. He came back with one hand shot off in the Marine Corps, so he wasn't going to be a surgeon. I went to see him in the Navy hospital, and he said, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "I'm going to be a writer." And he said, "All right, I'll be one too." So he went to journalism school and spent his life as writing a great column for the Dallas Morning News, Poor Larry's Almanac, a human interest column. Wrote a book or two and then died early. Died at the typewriter. Anyway, that's digressing away from...
Did they tell you in journalism school that the pay was going to be low, the hours rotten?
All that.
Holidays. Weekends.
All that stuff.
They told you that?
They didn't tell me that. I started out at $55 a week, I recall. Couldn't get a job at first. First job I got was in radio writing Purina Pig Chow commercials and Cane's Better Coffee commercials for an advertising agency. And it paid even worse.
It paid worse?
Yeah.
Journalism?
It's journalism in a sense. Because it was a temporary part-time slave labor intern type job. See, it was all I could get.
Where was this?
It was in Oklahoma City.
Mm-hmm. So, after working in newspapers for a long time, you went to United Press, right?
Yeah.
And what did you do for them?
I was a political writer. And then I wanted to get back to New Mexico. And the opening came in the Santa Fe Bureau. The bureau manager got sick. And I got to transfer out to run the State Capitol Bureau in Santa Fe in 52. Then I went back to the newspaper and to the New Mexican. I was editor of the New Mexican in Santa Fe, the state capital paper there. But I always want, I mean, by that time I was really wanted to write fiction. I really wanted to write, the great American novel. So I dropped out of that and went back to school and studied Shakespeare and Chaucer and modern poetry and all that jazz. See if I could learn something.
And you did.
Yeah, I really did. I had a great teacher, several great teachers.
When you went back to school, was it actually creative writing that you were...
Well, I first took a bunch of basic English courses that I hadn't taken, as I wanted to take, Chaucer, Shakespeare, etc. Then I enrolled as a graduate student in creative writing and had a prof named Morris Friedman, who used to be an editor of Commentary magazine. And man, that guy could write. Not only could he write, but he could spot your weakness. And he wouldn't let me write to my strength, which I wanted to do. He made me... forced me to, write first person, all those things that you hate to do when you're a journalist, see?
First person is easy to write when you're dealing with fiction.
Yeah, but it's anathema to a reporter.
Oh, yeah.
And
it's interesting that first person doesn't always come off well unless you're writing about yourself. I'm thinking of Catcher in the Rye by Salinger. I just did a... interview with his alleged biographer, Ian Hamilton.
Oh, yeah.
Not much of a biography, actually. But Salinger wrote a first-person story about a 15-year-old boy. I'm sure you've read it.
I sure have, yeah.
And it's flawless. He doesn't take you beyond this kid's 15th year. But many people, if they're writing about other people in the first person, it often doesn't work because they're not that person.
True. I agree. Uh-huh. Also agree about Salinger's The Perfection of Catcher in the Rye. What a great little book that is.
Yeah. I invited him to come on the show today, but I thought we'd all sit around chatting, but he didn't answer my note. It's like...
He's sort of maintained his privacy rather well until this biography sort of blew his cover.
Really, it did.
If he hadn't have come out and filed suit, I think he would have been all right. That was a mistake. Getting all that stuff on record.
Well, the biography. Well, there's nothing really on record. His papers had always been available.
Oh.
And even though the letters are not quoted directly in the book, they're quoted in the transcripts of the hearing, and you can read them. They've been published in the New York Times.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, you can read them. But he, as Ian Hamilton said, he wrote a very self-conscious letter. And as a result, he never really revealed himself in his letters.
I see.
So the letters were of value mostly for their chronology, but also to shed some light on him.
Uh-huh.
So you read this book, you find out that I want to get back to you in a minute, but we're digressing for a second. But you find out that he was married to a woman who was a doctor, a French woman. We know her first name. He was married to her for less than a year, and that's it.
We don't even know her last name?
We don't. As far as I know, her last... well, maybe it's in the book. I can't remember. But
yeah.
That's all we really know. She's vanished.
You know, why should we, really? What business is it of ours? Don't you agree? To know the man's private life. Maybe later on, if he really begins influencing American literature, then we have a legitimate interest in who is this fellow who bent American letters to the left or right or, you know, up or down. But I don't think Salinger's going to do that. He left us a little classic and some other good stuff. And, you know, I mean, I'm willing to grant him his privacy.
Well, I am too. And I agree that I don't think he's going to have a major influence on American literature, but he's had a major influence on American minds.
He sure has, hadn't he?
And when I was a teenager, I read them. Maybe I was in my early 20s, but it had that same impact on me that it had on so many others. You know, the kid from Hawaii who murdered John Lennon carried this book around like a talisman. So from that, Salinger had influenced so many people that they're intrigued by him and they want to know more. It's obvious that he is a recluse and probably is not, he's eccentric. I guess that's the best thing you can do to describe him. But there is a curiosity about him.
I sometimes think writers that are willingly go on these 21-day book tours are more eccentric than Salinger.
Either that or masochistic.
Masochistic.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, you're on a tour now, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm about to finish it.
You seem very relaxed and spontaneous. You must be kind of like.
I sort of lapsed into numbness about Denver, I think it was.
Are you numb now?
Numb now, yeah.
Well, I'll hasten this a little bit. But you taught for a long time, didn't you?
Taught 20 years, yeah, at the University of New Mexico.
Journalism.
Journalism.
Meanwhile, lusting to...
Meanwhile, no, I was writing. I was writing, I started, my first book was published in 70, so I was, when I was sitting in those dreary faculty meetings, I was looking intelligent and listening. I was, you know, really into Chapter 9, getting a reputation for being a good listener and working on my book.
Well, tell me a little bit about how you approach writing. Do you carefully outline your
prose? No, I thought you should and tried and retried and finally found I couldn't, and I've never been able to outline anything. Still don't. I start with some basic ideas. This book, I saw a poster that said A Thief of Time across the top of it. BLM, Bureau of Land Management poster, or exhorting people to help prevent pot hunting, see? These people were stealing time from us. I thought, man, that's a great title for a book, and it's also a pretty good subject for a book behind here if I can come up with a plot and stuff. See, so that's how that started. And I was the setting should be, I thought, Chaco Canyon and some other isolated places where the ruins remain unspoiled. Had one character. I start thinking about it. I write a first chapter, throw it away, it doesn't work. A couple more first chapters that don't work. Finally, I get a first chapter that fit, that seems to be going somewhere, and by now the story, I'm beginning to get a feel for the book, and you know, and then I go over to Chaco, and I spend 2 or 3 days there, and talk to the anthropologists, and take a float trip down to San Juan, two of them, to look at these canyons I want to use, and keep floundering along and getting stuck and putting it aside for weeks while, you know, when I can't think of where to go from here and backing up. And it's a hideously inefficient way to do anything, but it's the only way I've ever been able to work.
Writing fiction is, I don't know how anybody approaches fiction except in a very haphazard way. There's no form or standard, is there?
I think immediately of the late, great Louis L'Amour, who wrote one a month, or practically, for I think he, 100 and something.
Mm-hmm.
He must have had some efficient way worked out. And his early books were really, a lot of them were good. His last books were, you know, needed some work that they didn't get, I thought, but he wrote some good stuff.
He wrote fast, but he was a great researcher too. I don't know that he actually covered the territory that you covered, of going down rivers and things like that, but he had this huge library, and he was a rare book collector, and he bought hundreds, thousands of books, mostly about the West, about weapons, and he had these double, maybe you know the story, he had these specialized bookshelves installed in his study in Los Angeles so that he could put a row of books behind the first row. And I can't quite visualize, but the first row would swing out, and he could see behind.
Oh,
so they
really?
Were double. And he spent a fortune on rare books. And so when he started to write, most of his stuff was right there in his own study.
So he could reach out and grab it.
And he wrote other things than the West. He did some things that took place during the Crusades and this sort of thing. But he collected books on those, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I know he had a tremendous reputation in that respect for not being wrong about how you lowered a stirrup on a whole, you know, in a certain kind of side, all that stuff, all those details. He was, if you saw it in the L'Amour book, it was right.
And he started, I guess you have to say, low. I mean, his early books were all paperbacks, paperback originals.
Yeah.
And subsequently, Bantam brought them out in hardcover, and they even had a Louis L'Amour book club. Only Louis L'Amour books.
Well, my oldest son is a Louis L'Amour fan, and I don't think my oldest son's ever finished one of my books. He claims he has, but...
You won an Edgar for one of your Navajo books, didn't you?
I won the Edgar for Dance Hall of the Dead, and then, to my delight, the Skinwalkers won the Golden Spur Award for from the Westernized American. I won a French award also for... what was that for? For Dance Hall of the Dead. They gave it their Grand Prix for... translate for a foreign book. It was translated over there last, I guess, published last year.
You're president of the American Mystery Writers Association.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
What do you have to do?
The understanding is you'll do absolutely nothing except keep your nose clean and not interfere into the operations of the organization.
Now, they have an executive director.
They have a executive. They have a board of directors, which actually runs the organization, and always has, and does a good job of it. And they elect a kind of a token president. It's sort of like being Queen Elizabeth. Margaret Thatcher runs a country, and Queen Elizabeth is, you know, there for ceremonial purposes.
Well, you show up at meetings from time to time.
Well, hopefully you don't show up very often.
Just let us run our club
right.
The way we want to.
Yeah, and it's fine. I enjoy the honor and I don't do them any damage. And
no, you do them honor. In fact, Tony Hillerman, are you going to stay in my last question? Are you going to stay in Navajo country?
I'm writing a book now, which again concerns both of those Navajo tribal policemen. It brings them, unless I change my mind, to the Smithsonian Institution, and a crime that's their concerns, this controversy over returning bones or not returning bones, but it's a long ways from finished. And it also takes you to a Yabiche ceremonial, a very colorful masked ceremonial, curing ceremonial. Unfortunately, it's held in a bitter cold part of the year.
Well, these are wonderful books, and you're steadily building an audience with each one, so bring back more.
No, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.